Now, friends, like most people in the professions, we clergy have our own professional magazines to read. They help us keep abreast of current thinking and help us think of issues that may impact on our ministry. Well, recently I came across a particular article in this leadership magazine which I found very enlightening. It was called Seven Signs for a Pastor to Know That It's Time to Move On. 1. You wake up from a sermon in which you are preaching, you wake up from a dream in which you are preaching a terrible sermon and you are. 2. It's 6 months since someone new has visited your church and he was only there to read the gas meter. 3. Your secretary answers the phone by saying, "Yeah, he's still here." 4. You keep getting nasty notes from a critic and the handwriting looks suspiciously like your wife's. 5. The church's voicemail system includes the option to complain about Sunday's sermon, press 3. 6. The church wardens ask you to change your day off to a Sunday. And the 7th sign for a pastor to know that it's time to move on, you are ill and the PCC sends you a get well card by a one vote majority. Some of the challenges in being a pastor. But if we who are pastors are sometimes perhaps a bit thick about getting the message that it's time to move on in our ministry, Jesus in his ministry never was. And this, of course, is what we've been seeing in our recent studies in Mark's Gospel. Jesus is at the end of a particular type of ministry with his disciples. He knows the end is near, and it's time now for him to move towards Jerusalem, that place towards which his whole life's focus has been heading. After 2 years of being with the disciples, Peter, on behalf of the others, has made that famous confession. We saw it last week, Mark chapter 8, verse 29. Jesus says, "What about you? Who do you say I am?" And Peter answers on behalf of the disciples, "You are the Christ." So Peter's come to realize, with all those miracles that have occurred, that Jesus is God's anointed ruler. And so because of that understanding that Peter and the others have received, Jesus now knows it's time to move on. And as he moves on, he explains to the disciples just what sort of ruler he's going to be and what he's come to do. And then he explains what that will mean for them as his followers. Now we'll see what he says summarized in two simple phrases in our passage. What has Jesus come to do? Verse 31, the Son of Man must suffer. And what will that mean for his disciples? Verse 34, if anyone would come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. He must suffer and die, and so must we. Now, I want to look at what that means by unpacking this text. So first, let's look at verses 31 to 33. The Son of Man must suffer. Now, as someone who was once a school teacher, a basic principle of teaching is this. You don't start teaching lesson 2 until the pupils have first grasped lesson 1. It has taken the disciples 8 chapters of Mark to grasp lesson 1, that Jesus was the Messiah. And the moment they've got it, Jesus immediately tells them to keep quiet about it. Look back at verse 30. Jesus warned them not to tell anybody about him. Why? For he knows that they would preach that message about him being the Messiah incorrectly until they've discovered and understood lesson 2. And so he begins his second lesson. Verse 31. He then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, chief priests and teachers of the law, and that he must be killed and after 3 days rise again. And he spoke plainly about this. You see, Jesus previously has been speaking in parables, but now he wants his disciples to know exactly what is about to occur. And note what he says. Look back at verse 31. First of all, the Son of Man must suffer. That is, his future suffering is all going to be part of God's divine plan. It will not be an accident when you see it happen, he says to them. It's meant to be. Two, it would be at the hands of the leaders, the elders, the chief priests and teachers of the law. That is, it's going to be a totally complete rejection. Not one person amongst all the leadership of Israel will recognize who he really is. And three, he says, and he will be killed, and after 3 days, rise again. That is, this rejection of him by Israel leaders will not be the end of the story, for it will be overturned in a most startling way. The tragedy will lead to triumph. Now, what Jesus is doing here is bringing together two strands of prophecy in the Old Testament. That which Peter and the other disciples already knew about, namely about a Messiah in the Old Testament that they read about who would reign and conquer all. And Jesus combines that with another strand of prophecy. We had it read before in Isaiah 53, the prophecy of a suffering servant. Remember that reading? Yet it was the Lord's will to crush him, says Isaiah, to cause him to suffer. My righteous servant will justify many, and he will bear their iniquities. Jesus is that Messiah whom Peter and the other disciples understood, the glorious king, but he is a king who will suffer. Jesus rules, but he rules from the tree. He exercises his victory, his justifying of the many, not by worldly power, but through the suffering sacrifice on a cross. The righteous for the unrighteous, the innocent for the guilty. Now notice, incidentally, in our passage that we see both those strands in the title that Jesus gives to himself, the Son of Man. That's his preferred title in the Gospels. Now, the origin of that title is in Daniel chapter 7. So just flick back to Daniel chapter 7. Keep one finger in Mark chapter 8. And it's on page 891. 891. This is where Jesus takes up this title for himself, Son of Man. Daniel chapter 7, verse 13. In my vision at night I looked, and there before me, says Daniel, was one like a Son of Man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into his presence, and he was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. And all peoples, nations, and men of every language worshipped him. And his dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away. And his kingdom is one that will never be destroyed. So who is this one that Daniel sees? Well, he's one who is truly a man, yet he's this as well. He's the true man, just like us, a Son of Man. Yet he's one who comes with the clouds of heaven. He's one who is led into the presence of God, who's given authority and power, whose dominion will never pass away. Human lowliness and divine glory both brought together, and that's Jesus. And we see that in this passage. Mark chapter 8, verse 38. Look at the end of our section of Mark. He says, if anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, here it comes, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes in his Father's glory with the holy angels. But then, back to verse 31. Who is this Son of Man? He is the one who must suffer many things. You see, who would have dreamt of putting those two things together? The sufferer who dies on the cross will come again with the angels on the great day of glory at the end. But that's our Christian creed. This is the God-man. And he announces to his disciples that he's going to take up a cross. But note Peter's response, verse 32. Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. The word rebuke in that verse is the same strong word that we read earlier in Mark's gospel when Jesus silenced the demons. So we could read, Peter tried to silence Jesus, to stop him talking about all this suffering and rejection and dying. But Jesus knows it's the only way. Verse 33, "Get behind me, Satan," he said. "You do not have in mind the things of God, but the things of men." Now, it seems to me that here, in a nutshell, is our human problem defined. It's the old problem of human pride and arrogance. Someone has defined pride as the only disease known to man that makes everyone sick except the one who has it. And an arrogant person is someone who does a crossword puzzle with a ballpoint pen. Well, there's some truth in that. For right from the beginning, Satan has been appealing to that part in each of us that won't let God be God, and instead insists that we know what is right for us. And many people do the same thing when it comes to the cross. In his book, Christ the Controversialist, John Stott quotes an Oxford professor's disdain on this biblical teaching of the necessity of the cross. This is what the professor writes. He says, "The ultimate scandal of Christianity lies not in dogma or symbolism, but in its intolerable offence to human pride. Nothing in my hand I bring, simply to the cross I cling. It is that which a man of taste and culture simply cannot say. He feels no need of such a salvation. To him, therefore, it's nonsense and mere mythology to say that the majesty of God should take a servant's form. It is the reason for the aversion of men of taste to evangelical religion." Friends, is that not human pride and arrogance? But like a skillful surgeon, Jesus goes directly to the very root of Peter's problem. Peter's not thinking God's way. He's not letting God set the agenda for what he, Peter, needs and what we, the world, needs. Rather, he's thinking his own way, setting his own agenda. And he says to Peter, and he says to any of us who are equally proud and arrogant in our attitude to Jesus, saying, "We don't really need all this dying on the cross stuff for us, Lord." He says to us, "The Son of Man must suffer many things." Friends, there are no exceptions. It's the only way that sin can be dealt with, for we cannot deal with it by ourselves. A few years ago on holiday, my family and I went to the Waterford Crystal Factory in Ireland. And of all the places that we were taken on in our tour of the factory, the one that held most fascination to us was the furnace room, where the glass is melted and blown into shape. And in the centre of that room were two huge furnaces, each generating a heat of 1400 degrees Celsius. Now let me tell you, 1400 degrees Celsius is hot. It's white hot. It's hot enough to melt glass and hot enough to kill anybody who might get too close. And whenever any of the craftsmen approached the furnaces, they did so not flippantly, but with great respect and awe for its power and intensity. And the Bible tells us that is what God is like. Hebrews 12 says, "Our God is an all-consuming fire." That is, we cannot approach God in our sinfulness, or else we will die. And that's why the Son of Man had to suffer. He did it for us. Our sins were placed upon him and burnt up in him so that we can approach God freely and be free. And he was the only one who could do it, the God-man, and he did it for us. So, the Son of Man must suffer. What should we do? How are we meant to respond to it? And Jesus goes on, and if we are to follow that Son of Man, we must be willing to do the same. Let's look briefly now at verses 34 to 38. Jesus then called the crowd to him along with his disciples and said, "If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for me and for the gospel will save it. For what good is it for a man to gain the whole world, yet forfeit his soul? Or what can a man give in exchange for his soul? If anyone is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of him when he comes in his Father's glory with his holy angels." Now, just around the corner from where I live, there's a building where one of the major banks does all its training. And the other day when I walked past, I noticed not only a woman standing outside greeting everybody as they walked past. I guess she was modelling the sort of welcome that the bank hoped all their staff would give their customers. But I noticed also inside the door a huge sign which simply said, "The winning team, the winning team." Now, I've been reflecting on this passage and I wondered, what would Jesus make of that sign? Yes, we as Christians are on the winning team. Christ has won the victory and we know that our destiny lies with him. And we need that to help us keep going when things get tough. But the surprise of these verses is that our winning comes only by our losing. For what is a follower of Jesus called to do? Verse 34, "If anyone would come after me," says Jesus, "he must deny himself." Now, friends, isn't that language the exact opposite of everything that we get thrust at us day by day? We live in an age not of self-denial, but that tells us that we have to fulfill ourselves. The actress Shirley MacLaine said this once in an interview. She said, "The most pleasurable journey you can take is through yourself. The only sustaining love is with yourself." When you look back on your life and try to figure out where you've been and where you're going, when you look at your work and your love affairs and your marriages and your children, your pain, your happiness, when you look at it all closely, what you really find out is that the only person you can really go to bed with is yourself. The only thing you have working to the consummation of your identity is yourself. And that's what I've been trying to do all my life. That is the prevailing culture. We may not put it exactly like it, but that's what most people think life is all about. But Jesus says if you're going to follow him, you have to do the opposite. Not a desire to save your life, but you have to be willing to lose your life to save it. If anybody would come after me, they must deny themselves. Now, that denial of ourselves will mean different things for each one of us. For some of us, it might mean security. We have a need to accumulate more and more things. It's been said that God doesn't mind us making money, he just minds us serving it. And if you're anything like me, the line between those two things is very fine indeed. And Jesus says to us, if that's what we're on about, if that's our temptation, security, he says, deny yourself in that area. Decide that you don't need that new outfit. Decide you don't need that bigger car, and instead discover the grace of giving. For others of us, it might be ambition, a drive to be recognised by others. And again, there's nothing wrong with godly ambition. But there is something wrong if that ambition means that all my energy and time is going into a desire to get ahead rather than into the nurturing of my soul. And Jesus says, what good is it for a person to gain the whole world yet lose their soul? Security, ambition, maybe relationships, even our families, our spouses, our children, they can become the centre of our lives. And if so, if we search our hearts and recognise that, Jesus says, if anyone is to come after me, we must deny ourselves. But then he adds the next chilling words, and take up his cross. Now I say they're chilling words for the people that Jesus was first speaking those words to. In fact, Christians for the first few centuries all knew the agonizing reality of that Roman form of punishment. They would have seen it regularly about them, and therefore they would have known that Jesus was saying to them, commitment to following me, commitment to being a disciple, may mean for you martyrdom of that extent, being put up on a cross and dying of thirst, exposure, and the collapse of your internal organs. Now, only a few people would have actually become martyrs in that way, but there's been a steady stream of them down the centuries. So it has actually literally been fulfilled. But it's been fulfilled in other ways as well. On Friday, I was at a service in Westminster Abbey. It was a service for Australia. That is, a service commemorating the centenary of the passing of the Federation Bill through Westminster. And it was a great occasion. The building was great in its splendour. There was the pomp and majesty of the service. All the important people were there at the church service. The Prime Minister, four previous Prime Ministers, High Court judges, the Lord Mayor, the Queen herself and Prince Philip. And we all stood up and gazed over each other to get a good view. But as I left the building and looked up, I saw on the side of the building not those that we human beings think are the important people, but those whom God thinks are the important people. For there on the side of the abbey are the statues of the modern martyrs. You seen them? Those nine lonely figures from every corner of the globe who were killed for their witness to Christ this century. And it struck me, it's there that the heart of true Christianity lies. Not in our ceremonies and services, but in the lives of those Christians who were willing to take up the cross literally and die for their Saviour. And I had to ask myself the question, would I be willing to do the same? And my prayer is, Lord, when it comes to the crunch, please help me to be willing. Deny yourself, take up your cross, and thirdly, follow me. And this last imperative of Jesus speaks not so much of what we're called to give up, but rather on what we're called to take on, the commitment to follow Christ and follow him and live our lives for him and for the gospel. Well, friends, let me conclude. Two great imperatives. The Son of Man must suffer, and that's what we're remembering tonight at Holy Communion. The offer that Christ is making to us, the gift of new life, free and full forgiveness for our sins, a relationship of love with the one who loves us the most. That's what we're offered. But here's the cost. If anyone would come after me, they must deny themselves, take up their cross, and follow me. That's the call. Nothing hard-baked, no bargaining with God. Lord, I'll give you this much of your offer, and I'll take that much of your offer, and I'll give you this bit of my life and keep the rest to myself. No, it's a call, friends, to wholehearted discipleship. But discipleship that we seek to fulfill not on our own, but with the one who has actually worn the path of discipleship before us and who makes it all possible. Jesus tells his disciples and he tells us, this is what I've come to do, and I'm calling you to do the same. 180 years after the death of Emperor Charlemagne, in the year 1000 AD, officials of the Emperor Otto opened the great king's tomb, and they found an amazing sight. For there, amongst countless treasures, was the skeleton of King Charlemagne, seated upon a throne, with the crown on his head, with the copy of the Gospels lying in his lap, and one bony finger resting on the text, Mark 8:36. What good is it for a man to gain the whole world, yet forfeit his soul? Friends, to be a Christian is to realise that all the world has to offer is nothing if we end up losing that which is most precious of all, our lives and our souls. Let's spend some time in quiet now as we seek the Lord on these things. Just take the moment now to examine ourselves before the Lord, to hear his word to us, and ask him to grant us the willingness to daily offer ourselves to the one who gave his all for us.